Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today we are thrilled to have Joshua Gams. Joshua holds the Jeffrey C. Skoll Chair in Technical Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, where he is the Professor of Strategic Management. At Rotman, he teaches MBA and Commerce students network and digital market strategy. His research is primarily focused on understanding the economic drivers of innovation and scientific progress and has core interests in digital strategy and antitrust policy. He holds a PhD from Stanford, yay, and an honors degree in economics from the University of Queensland. Joshua has also co-authored the Australia-Asia edition of Greg Manquiz's Principles of Economics, Core Economics for Managers, Finishing the Job, Parentonomics, and Information Wants to Be Shared. His most recent book is The Disruption Dilemma, which is why we have him on the show today. He also served on the editorial board of Management Science, and advisor of the Brattle Group, managing director of the Core Research Consultancy, and writes regularly for Forbes HBR. You can follow him on Twitter, which is how we found him. His Twitter handle is at Josh Gams. That's J-O-S-H-G-A-N-S. So, Joshua, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
And are you in Toronto right now?
Yes.
Awesome. Well, I love Rotman School. We've had Roger Martin on here, actually, on the show a couple times, and he's a good friend, buddy, and I love what you guys are doing there.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. So before we get into the book particularly, will you talk a little about your career path and how you decided to write this particular book?
Sure. So as you already mentioned, I got my PhD in economics at Stanford University some time ago. I've had a long-standing interest in studying innovation and innovation strategy in economics. Since that time. And basically, you know, one of the things that has been discussed for most of my career has been the difficulties that incumbent firms have in responding to certain sorts of innovations. Although, while that's a topic that's been discussed quite a bit, there hasn't been very much in terms of thinking about all we know about that topic, and so that's why I wrote the book.
Okay. And one of the things I noticed about the book is that, there's many things, but one of them was that you spent some time talking about Clay Christensen's work from, gosh, it must have been 20 years now?
Yeah.
His book, of course, 20 years ago, The Innovator's Dilemma. So, I'd like you to spend just a couple minutes talking about what his main treatise was and then how you have shifted that and what you talked about in your book that sort of went against it in some respects. So
sure.
Could you kind of give people kind of the idea here what was then and what is now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
So the main issue that all this is about is why firms who are at the top of their game and seem to be doing everything right tend to get into trouble. So Christensen's approach was to say, well, you know, there are certain sorts of innovations that successful firms have trouble deciding to pursue. And the reason is because they are innovations where their customers don't actually really want the new innovation right now, but it turns out that in, you know, 5 years' time, they'll change their mind. And so that's a particular dilemma. So, you know, you might have a customer, you might be selling computers, and your customer might want very large hard drives that can store a lot of things, and they're your main customers, and then some new smaller hard drive comes along. It can't store as much, but it's a little bit more portable and energy efficient. So you go to your existing customers and say, hey, there's this new technology. here. It's a smaller hard drive. Do you want that? And they go, well, no. We like your product. So we don't think you should do that. And so that creates a dilemma for these firms
right.
in that they know their customers don't want change right now, but they also know that, you know, maybe they'll change their mind in the future. And, you know, a lot of firms have trouble navigating that trade-off. And so obviously firms that choose to stay with the old risk getting displaced by the new.
Mm-hmm.
Firms that jump into the new too early end up perhaps losing their customers and losing customer loyalty and things like that. So that was Christensen's main theory with regard to how these large firms could get into trouble. And his book was about that theory, and also it was about trying to look at some evidence to see whether, you know, what he then ended up calling disruption, you know, could actually account for why some successful firms failed.
So his dilemma then is innovating too soon. I mean, I think that another example would be like cloud computing and people trying to get onto cloud when they want to stick with their hard drive kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it took a while for that to come to fore. Now, of course, it's, you know, ubiquitous.
Right.
So that was what he described as the dilemma. So then, when you talk about the disruptive dilemma in your book, how does that contrast to that?
Well,
and compare.
So on a couple of fronts. So, as I mentioned earlier, one of my goals was to say, well, what have we really learned about all of this stuff? So Christensen's book was 20 years ago, and while he's written stuff since then, it's been largely along the same theme. But as it turns out, that, you know, his work had dire predictions for a lot of firms. Very successful, and they might get into trouble as a result of some of these disruptive innovations coming along. But actually, while there are certainly some cases of successful firms failing, they didn't happen as often as his theory sort of made out it should. And also, where it did happen, the story didn't quite fit. It wasn't these firms were, you know, not pursuing the new thing for their customers or things like that. You know, a good case in point is Kodak. Kodak,
yeah.
You know, the narrative goes, is, you know, the world's leading filmmaker, and of course digital comes along and that's it for it. But actually, Kodak were actually a pioneer in digital photography, and particularly brought the sort of first successful ones to the consumer market many years before anyone else. And so, you know, it didn't fit that they, you know, didn't actually try and pursue this. They actually did. What was probably, so the way I thought about it was this, is at the same time that Christensen was developing his theory, another PhD student, Christensen was a PhD student at the time, another PhD student at Harvard, Rebecca Henderson, was studying the same phenomenon and had a different theory. Her theory, rather than looking outward to how do the customers react, it looked inwards into the organization of innovative teams inside the organizations and firms itself. And what she found is that, you know, firms that were very set on innovating all the time very quickly had to organize themselves into very specialized teams to do so, you know, each sort of working on different components or different modules, and being largely left on their own. Because you know, not having senior management meddling in your affairs was good for rapid innovation. And of course, the problem is that sometimes new things come along, and they don't just require more innovation. In fact, they're not necessarily more innovative right then and there, but they're sort of put together in a different way. And in order to move to the path of these things, you have to sort of reorganize your whole organization. So this is not just simply like Christians were saying, well, we have a problem, do we change the product now or later? This was, you know, do we razor our otherwise successful organization to get on some mm-hmm. new bandwagon. And when we do that, we have no particular advantages either. So it's like a terrible decision to make. She was studying industries, and she said, well, you know, what's really causing these firms to fail are these supply-side factors that it just, you know, firms kind of know what's going on, but, you know, they just can't basically almost kill themselves to deal with it.
Yeah. Just understand, so you're talking about, like, the market's changing, they can't change their business model or their business structure?
Well, it's like the business model, it all goes through their organization. So Kodak, you know, all of their incentives and everything was around making money off film. I mean, even when they build out digital cameras, their goal was to get people taking pictures and then printing them. Mm-hmm. So it was still very mm-hmm. focused on development and part of that traditional chain. And so for Kodak to sort of change away from that, you know, they would have to ignore the most profitable part of their business and in the core mm-hmm. forever. So, you know, mm-hmm. not surprisingly, that was hard to, you know, in their case, actually impossible to do. So mm-hmm. what was interesting about Henderson's work, however, is that, like, it wasn't all firms that succumbed to these issues. There were actually, mm-hmm. it was actually an affliction of the top firms in the industry. The sort of, this number two firm or whatever, number three firm, often in industries, could actually seem to be able to ride out these changes. So while the top firm would see no more, the number two or number three would sort of seemingly, every time a new change came in, yeah, they'd be a little bit slow, but they'd survive it. And the reason she found for that was these number two and three were doing something different than the top firm. They were not organizing themselves for rapid innovation. In fact, they were, you know, had a far more integrated approach. There weren't teams that were all independent all over the place able to innovate without anyone interfering with them. Instead, you know, there were people going around making sure what they were doing was compatible with everybody else. So what that meant was when the next big thing came along, it was much easier for those firms to sort of adjust to it because they hadn't sort of ossified themselves into one particular track, and they were a bit more flexible. And so that was her message. And so the disruption dilemma, as I talk about it, is that trade-off. Do you go for gold now, or do you settle for silver every year?
Mm-hmm. And?
Oh, there's no answer. It's a dilemma. You know, the thing about dilemmas is they've got to be a dilemma.
Right.
You've got to choose which way to resolve them. If I could tell you the answer, it wouldn't be a dilemma. It would be a here's what you should do.
Right. So let's pick some of the companies that we know about that are obvious. So like BlackBerry, for example.
Yes.
They were silver for... Well, they were gold for a while.
No, they were gold. They were gold.
They were gold.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. They were an absolute pioneer in, you know, what we now term as smartphones, internet-connected devices.
Right.
You know, people loved their BlackBerries.
I did. I was one of
You know, Hillary Clinton loved the BlackBerry so much she clearly has come up with the only risk to her becoming president as a result of that product. So let's not doubt how powerful it was. We're just forgotten now. And... So, you know, the iPhone comes along and Android comes along, and it's not like that those were, you know, technically superior. You know, they were just put together differently, at least at the outset.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, BlackBerry, well, you know, they had been very focused on providing this very robust hardware and lots of security and all sorts of other things. And, you know, they and their teams were organized that way. And so... they didn't recognize that, you know, they couldn't quite build an iPhone. In fact, they thought initially that they could, and they launched a BlackBerry to compete with the iPhone, and it looked like they might do it, except it just didn't work. And it didn't work because you had to. An iPhone is actually very, very different from a BlackBerry in terms of its co-design of software and hardware and all sorts of things
mm-hmm.
like that. So BlackBerry are an excellent example of the supply side disruption, where they just didn't have the organization to be able to do what Apple and Samsung and others were doing. And they weren't alone. Every single handset maker that was big, successful, Nokia, Sony Ericsson, Motorola, they all went.
Right.
This is the characteristics of these sorts of innovations. The incumbents are handicapped. And in that industry, it was clear.
Right. So you talked about the idea of supply side disruption. Can you mention a little bit about the demand side?
Well, the demand side disruption is the disruption theory that Christensen came up with. This dilemma, do you serve the customer the new thing or let them have the old thing for a bit longer? do you decide not to listen to your customer or not when everything is telling you should listen to your customers?
Okay. So that's the difference. Okay.
Yeah, so that's that side. Now, the main difference between sort of demand side and supply side disruption is that supply side disruption, if you're not prepared for it, you can't do anything about it once it comes.
Mm-hmm.
With demand side disruption, firms have shown themselves, they sort of missed the boat a little bit and they sort of stumble, but they don't fall. And so that they can, they can marshal resources like Microsoft did to meet the threat of Netscape, or they can acquire the potential disruptors like Facebook did with Instagram, or they could simply, it turns out they might have a secure position and just be able to wait them out anyway. So, other things that they are doing that are essential. So, demand side disruption is sort of, it can be there, but It is not fatal necessarily in the same way that supply side disruption can be.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's interesting. So, obviously, Blockbuster, another one that went off. We actually use the term, Blockbuster got Netflix, and we actually use that term Netflix for a lot of other things.
Although that story isn't quite true either, right?
So
Blockbuster. So which firm, which firm in 2000 launched the first on-demand streaming service?
Blockbuster
did so. Now, arguably it did it too early, but it's not like it didn't understand there was something good about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, Netflix came in, but Netflix, could do all this stuff, and then it did DVDs first, and then it did streaming. But it didn't have the latest release movies or anything like that. It was a very different thing. In fact, what really happened was that the cable companies launched their on-demand services. And we had other ways of renting videos, such as the iTunes music store and iTunes video store and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, while Netflix gets held up as the big disruptor, it actually was a team effort. to do that. But the problem is that Blockbuster didn't have any advantage in the new game. And it had some big anchors in bricks and mortar stores, which really couldn't afford to lose customers.
Yeah, they were burdened by the brick and mortars, essentially.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, whereas, the cable companies weren't.
Right, right.
Okay, so talked about the scenarios here. We've given a lot of examples. So what do we do about it? I guess how do you manage? How does a vice president of product? You talked about integration, important integration,
right.
The way that you're even set up. So the idea of how one's set up is important, I assume. Also, how you develop product and suit is important.
Right.
So tell us a little bit more about your theories on that.
So it depends what you want to do. I mean, one way is to go with, the normal prescription and make sure you've got very focused teams on rapid improvement and innovation. But what this is basically saying is there's a cost to that, and it's, the cost of that is a short time, relatively short time at the top. But you might make a lot of money during that period of time, so that might be a good idea. The alternative is you can sort of choose the life of the firm by sacrificing that. So instead of having these teams geared for rapid innovation and to improve the components and always to have the first release of products better than everybody else, you can lag a bit behind. And, you know, that comes at a cost. You don't make as many sales. You won't be necessarily the leader in the industry. You'll be a bit slower off the mark. The share market will be screaming at you for, you know, couldn't you do a bit better right now? But that's what playing the long-term game is all about. And so if you do that, by making your organization far more flexible than you otherwise would, making sure there are people who rotate across teams, you break up silos that might be not talking to each other and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
None of those things is guaranteed that the next big thing comes along, you'll be able to deal with it. But what we know from experience is that tends to increase your chances quite a bit of being able to do that. So basically, it's having a tighter organization with very blurred functional divisions going on. I mean, much the same way as, you know, Apple currently operates now. Apple don't have these divisions with their separate profit and loss accounting and all those sorts of things going on. And the reason they say they do that is they want to keep all the parts talking to each other. And so it shouldn't surprise us that the share market thinks they're not doing as well as they should be.
Right.
And so, yes, it's the most valuable company in the world, but it is actually way undervalued compared to any other tech company. And secondly, it's always kind of a little bit slow to market. Like, people are sort of saying, why hasn't Apple released this thing yet that some other people have released? And the answer is, well, it's slowly doing its own processes. those are the types of things that happen there.
I see. Now, so what would be another example of a company that is, you know, sort of sitting back a little bit? And I'm thinking like LinkedIn, I'm thinking about that kind of company in terms of, you know, that they did something I was shocked by, which is, you know, that Microsoft bought them.
Right. That's a more complicated thing because LinkedIn is still really a startup doing so. But we're flipping it around, Microsoft buying them is the interesting thing, is that, you know, LinkedIn were becoming an important part of the sort of corporate landscape and in terms of communication. And so Microsoft are really all about communication in a corporate environment. So it seemed natural that they would eventually work out a way to buy LinkedIn to complement that, just as they bought Skype, for instance, and Yammer and other things that look like making inroads into that space.
Right, so really focusing on the B2B. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's awesome. So what's another example of a company that is, you know, sort of sitting back, as you said, being more flexible? I hadn't thought of Apple that way, so I actually, now that you're bringing it up, for example, like, you know, they bought Beat, but I'm not sure what they're doing new there yet.
Right.
Yeah, and they're maybe waiting a little bit. But, like, what are some other companies that are sort of lagging a little bit behind?
Facebook gets accused of that all the time, you know, lagging behind Snapchat or lagging behind sometimes Twitter or something like that in various things. But it ends up, you know, a year later coming to the party and and being fine.
Mm-hmm.
And they're notorious again for, you know, not having these functional boundaries, these silos. They don't have walls in the whole office, as near as I can tell. So they're very keen on that. There are companies that did this many years ago, like Fujifilm. Fujifilm didn't go the way of Kodak because 20 years ago it decided to say it wasn't a film company but an image company, and it started making its decisions on that basis. And that obviously put it in much better stead when film went away.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about some of these internal frameworks or internal practices that people could put together, and how do they become, I guess, smart to this. I mean, I think that thinking about how they can be ready to be Netflix, how do they set that up?
So, I'm sorry, so how do they...
Well, how, Liz, I want to talk a little bit more about the internal, so the internal processes to get people to ready to be able to face some of these supply side.
Right.
Knockdowns.
So it's not a,
you know,
it's not a thing. It's a very long term organization.
Right.
So when I said that Fujifilm managed to position itself, well, it started that work 20 years ago, so that 10 years ago when film was in trouble, it was in a good position. So it's really a matter of, slowly but surely completely reformulating your organization, if it indeed is already, if it is currently siloed or had focus teams and things like that. Now, how you actually go and make that transition, that's an extremely good question about how to do it. My research can point to, well, the organizations that chose a more integrated path tend to last longer and ride these waves of disruption, and we have some idea why. That is a very different question from saying, well, what are the things you can do right now to... forestall that, and really it's just that is a much longer process of change and change management. That there's no simple, one size fits all sort of things that I can say. I know I can point to some things like, if you wanted to do that, you would want to be cautious about having anything that looks like silos and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd want some managers and people who would rotate around teams and get to know someone who, some set of people who knows everything going on in the organization. Those are some of the elements involved, but there are probably other ways as well. It's just the mantra is sort of not forgetting your roots, sort of keeping it within the organization, understanding both the forest and the trees, really.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a lot of the companies that are in Silicon Valley. Some of the bigger companies that are post-IPO, I think it's harder to do this because you're already in a, as Roger talks about a lot, you're in the game of having to produce earnings. And it's much harder to do this, whereas a lot of these pre-IPO unicorns that have a ton of money, I mean, they have a little bit more flexibility to potentially do this, to get themselves prepared.
They can, although the flip side of it is that they have also, even ones that are sort of unicorns and seemingly have a lot of money, they've still got usually a long way to go.
Yeah.
So they can't afford to be, they can't afford to be diversified and things like that. What they can do is sort of like in their, the DNA of their organizations, start to put in some of these things I mentioned before. Facebook decided right from the get-go that it was going to not have silos. So, one of the things that it does is when new employees come to Facebook, they get rotated around regardless of, how quickly you want them to working on their specialty. That's the kind of longer-term thinking you have to
That's what I'm addressing, the idea of getting these things in place quickly, and even if they haven't done them, to start putting them in place now, so that it's hard, but it's not. I don't think it's as hard if you are already in the earnings rat race, if you will.
That's true.
Yeah. And so, what are some things also? So you've talked a lot about the what I would call approach or structures. What about strategy? So how do we focus on? How do we look at strategy in a way that helps us? It's almost like parallel pathing in a way. It's like this could happen. It's like scenario planning, maybe. How do we set ourselves up for not being in a, I guess, as much of a dilemma or accounting for that? Or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not much you... the dilemma sort of like exists. I mean, one thing that can be done is for instance, demand-side disruption is still real. It's something you want to be able to deal with effectively, even if you don't have to deal with it before the fact. And one of the great ways of being able to deal with that is to be able to acquire firms. And, most firms dealing with that sort of disruption of the Christensen type have ended up just acquiring the competitor that was an issue for them. Now, in order to do that effectively, you must not only acquire them, but you must absorb them and their thinking and the new technology and what they've learned so that you continue on. If you just If you just acquire them and shut them down, you're no better off because there'll be another competitor on the horizon.
Yeah, you
so,
gotta learn from them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you have to actually do that. Now, companies that have got very good, and a lot of the tech companies are like this, they start to get into the mode of acquiring a lot of other companies, and they develop procedures by which they can integrate
right.
them properly.
Right.
That's a capability that is one of these things you can do before the fact to help you be able to deal with adjustment afterwards.
So acquiring is one thing, and also from the demand side, I would think that design thinking and understanding customer is really going to be important. So to know that balance of okay, so they may not be ready, but if they're involved and you can push them a little bit, then maybe we can get it out there. But
right.
without knowing where they're at, it's harder to know that. So yeah. design research, design thinking, that kind of thing certainly would help that.
Right.
I would assume. You guess so, you said?
I guess so. I don't know what you're mad about it. Yeah.
So how do we, so from the demand side disruption, how do we not guess? How do we have to be really in touch with the customer to know
well,
what's going to work.
No, you can be in touch. Well, Christensen's idea is to not be in touch with the customers at all, and not necessarily listen to them, which I guess is a direct follow-on. But the issue is it's not so much just being in touch with your customers. The problem is that your customers don't know everything, and these new technologies are coming up, and so what you have to be is sort of actively monitoring what is coming forward as these new technologies so that you know that you can tell if something is getting traction and it looks like it's winning the race to become the next thing of the future. The main issue you face is that it would be costly for you to sort of research all those new technologies yourself and experiment with all of them and experiment on your customers with all of them to find out which is going to be the one that hits, because 9 out of 10 of them are going to be just bad.
Right.
So, you monitor the market and what's going on out there to see what seems to be working. And that's
the market research.
It's strategic.
Yeah.
It's seeing what's going on in the world, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also figuring out, too, it's market research, but it's also, it's not necessarily researching customers as to whether or not they're going to like your product. It's actually just researching, some researchers can say what the need is just generally.
Yeah, and you're
anticipating,
right.
Yeah.
And you have to make a forecast mm-hmm. that you think they're going to like this new thing, even if they don't know it yet.
Right, exactly.
So, that's obviously a difficult thing to do, but the first step is knowing what there is out there.
Yeah,
might be
I mean, isn't that sort of what Apple does? I mean, they figure that people are going to like it, and they've done a lot of research to figure that out. But
yeah,
Well,
they also they wait as well. I mean, they don't adopt the next big thing right away. They wait a period of time. I mean, they could have released a watch years before if they wanted to. Anyone can make a watch. But they were waiting until they got it to a point where they thought they could be adding value in a significant
mm-hmm.
way. And that seems to be what they do time and time again, actually.
And you just give another example, because it's all something we all know, do you think that they waited at the right time? Do you think that the watch is doing okay?
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, the Apple Watch, is a new sort of category of device. We're used to watches, that we don't have to charge and that we're not doing anything other than looking at the time on. Whenever you release a new category, it takes a while to even Apple to work out how it's supposed to work properly.
Right.
But this happened with the iPhone as well. The original iPhone didn't sell very well. It was very expensive, and actually it wasn't so great. It had a good foundation, and I think we'll find that might well be the same thing with the watch. It'll be no surprise to me, at least, to hear in 5 years' time that Apple has 50% of the world's watch market, which, when you think about it, would be pretty amazing.
Well, they kind of created, you're right, they kind of created a new category with both the iPad and the watch, because they really are a little bit different than...
Yeah. I mean, the iPad keeps on getting trumpeted at the moment with this huge failure, but it has sold several hundred million things, all from the one company, all with effectively no competition. I mean, I don't know what a blue sky market is, but that sounds pretty much like it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is really interesting. What are some other things that, from a, you know, there's a lot of people on the phone who are coaches, and there are some managers, some like that. But from a coach's perspective or consultant's perspective, what can we do to help our clients in terms of how to think like this? I mean, what are some things that they could start, the coaches on the call could start with in terms of helping their clients?
Well, I think it's hard to, as I said, different people are different in different situations.
Right.
But you know, there are sort of like warning signs.
Yes.
You know, warning signs are, you know, new products coming along and the organization just dismissing them without evaluating them. That would be a warning sign. You know, warning signs are situations where organizations, different parts of the organization just have no idea what other parts are doing. So those sorts of things, you know, so there's quite a few things that can be warning signs. What you do to sort of change those really depends on the organization itself. But there are
right.
some sort of cues and danger signals.
Right. What are some things that you talk about in your book? Do you go into those particular warning signs, or are there other things that you actually address in terms of looking at?
So we go. The book goes into a little bit of it, but it's not, I'll fully admit this, it is designed to get people thinking about the, you know, the sort of risks that are faced, but it doesn't sit there presenting all the answers, partly because one of the mantras was, it wasn't like supposed to be anecdotal. I wanted to put in their situations where people had really studied industries over a long period of time and were able to distill conclusions from them. So far more evidence-based. So that means
right.
that the book itself, you know, as a result, cannot read like, well, here are the 10 things you should do tomorrow, because, frankly, not only I, but no one actually knows what those 10 things are, and those are still being worked out. However, that doesn't mean that being unaware of these issues and some of the trade-offs involved can't resonate and can't get people thinking about things that may actually help.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is just getting people thinking about it. For example, the idea of, do you want to be gold or do you want to be silver, you know,
right.
more of the time and sit back. I mean, I think that that's
exactly,
really
even you know, because everybody always thinks, oh, we want to be gold. But that's my point is that historically, when you choose to be gold, you choose to be there for a shorter period of time than you would silver. And so, you know, most people would like to be gold and to live forever. But, you know, actually there's a trade-off.
Well, is there a way to do, and I know that this is sort of Silicon Valley to say, can you get your cake and eat it too? But, I mean, most of the companies and ones that are on the way to that, you know, have multiple products and have multiple services
yeah.
of products. So, I mean, isn't there a way to be gold and also be silver to you know, have that sort of, Apple, for example, I still need it their main gig. Well,
right.
I guess they sold a billion iPhones, so I would imagine that's their main gig, even though they sell probably a lot of Macs as well. But
yeah.
isn't it okay to be gold in one thing and then silver in the other to be so that you have that?
So remember, the important thing is that
portfolio.
The important thing to note is while we perceive them as such, Apple are far from gold in phones. They earn a lot of money. But, you know, they are constantly hit for the idea that, you know, well, why aren't, you know, why did they lose so much market share to Samsung and HTC and co. when they had a leadership and blah, 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 and surely you want to be number one. And so, you know, Apple were quite content not to sell more phones than anyone else. So, you know, that's that sort of mentality going on there. In other words, they could have chosen to do that. But they haven't.
Okay, so that's not a good example. Is there an example of a company that, I mean, maybe it's more about the timing, like you start out with like that sort of magical product and you're first in, first, you know, your market share is, you know, 60%.
Right.
And you've been doing that for a while, but you still want to rest on your laurels. So you either pull back on that or you start some other things that are that allow you to wait. I guess this is what I'm trying to say is, like, the goal allowed you to get there, so then it'd be a matter of sustainability. You have to develop other things. And
right.
So this is a very simplistic way of looking at it. I'm just wondering if that would be
matter. Yeah, yeah, that would be it. I'm trying to think of what's a company that's currently the sort of unassailed leader in something. it's hard to think of examples. Maybe this is the sign of the times.
What about Nike? Nike. I mean, they were sort of the leader, and then they sort of branched out to other things. And
yeah, no,
they're all over the Olympics.
Because they can do that. Look, the problem I just don't know enough about them is actually what I'm struggling with there, and I admit I don't know about every company, so I'm not sure.
Well, this has been really interesting. Is there anything else that you can address from either your experience or from your book? It sounds like your book is more research oriented, but perhaps from your experience and working with companies, working with students who are in companies.
Yeah.
That would be helpful to the people on the phone?
No, I think, I think the most useful things that I've seen happen in this sort of, like, thinking about disruptive threats is sort of bringing different parts of the organization together and
mm-hmm.
to go through what they perceive as the potential threats and to work through, you know, is it really a threat now or is it really in this 9 out of 10 category that it's very likely to fail? And if it didn't fail, that you'd have enough time to deal with it, you know. I've had countless companies who list as their number one threat for various reasons, drones. Any company apparently can work out how drones are a threat to them at the moment. But, you know, when pushed, it's, yeah, there's a theory there that a drone could be a threat, but there's also, like, if that was taking off, you'd have time to deal with it. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily upend your business. And so there are quite a few ones that fall into that category. It's the things that, the iPhone didn't look like a threat to BlackBerry and Nokia. They dismissed it. It's when those dismissing things are going on that it's worthwhile to ask yourself again, hey, who's doing the dismissing, and do they have they got the expertise to do that? Do they have the sense of the organization to do that?
Right. Yeah, what I've taken from the conversation is this idea of dismissing, because I think that we do this a lot, and we don't want to be paranoid, obviously, and, like, I think drones is a great example, or self-driving cars. I mean, it's like,
right.
Yeah, self-driving cars are fine, but it's a long time before we have a self-driving car.
Yeah, Although
yeah,
that could be one of these ones where, you know, existing car makers just won't be able to do it for some reason. But we just don't know. I mean, maybe they will. You know, that's the whole problem.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this idea that you know, first of all, getting people to spend time on looking at things 4 years from now is, you know, that alone is hard.
Right.
Just getting people to sit down and also making sure that it's a cross-functional team. So if there's a head of strategy, fine, but making sure that they're very T-shaped in their thinking and also getting a battery of people around the company. So I think that those are, you know, they sound basic on one level.
Yeah, but they tend to be forgotten. Yeah.
Exactly. As I was going to say, it just doesn't happen. Because people are too busy. You know, that's
right.
The main thing. So, well, thank you again, Joshua. I really appreciate it. I've taken a lot of notes. Going to do a lot of application, and I assume people will be listening to the world as well. Again, I wanted to note his book, Joshua's book, The Disruption Dilemma. And then following Joshua on Twitter is at Josh Gans, JOSHGANS. So thanks again. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
Really do. And tell Roger hello. I wanted to also let people know about next month. We are going to have Kat Lee, who's the head of partner marketing at Pinterest. So we try to get people who are inside organizations at least a couple times a year. So this is our chance on September 22nd at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 obviously Eastern, to listen to Kat. And Kat's interesting because she's in a company that is extremely disruptive. At the same time, she tends to be somebody who is very project focused and kind of, you know, is process oriented. And a lot of companies that are disruptive and are that first, you know, those first movers are don't have enough process in place. So she's going to be with us talking about that. Thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you in September. Bye now.
Thanks. Bye.